Welcome to the Full of Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 7:28 GMT. Today is November 2nd, and of course, it being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. Let's have a quick review of the week before we move on to some of those bigger themes. And this has been the week in which oil hit a new high above $95. In fact, it hit $96 earlier today. This was also the week in which gold surmounted the $800 level. Again, that was also today, but it has been quite firm throughout the week. I think this is the highest level in 27 years. This was also the week in which we've seen the US banking shares hitting new lows for this move. And those are some pretty pronounced downtrends. A bit more about that later. This was also the week in which a number of other gov or sorry stock market indices hit a little bit of resistance, having rallied very well from their mid-August lows. The Hong Kong index, which was the one that rallied the most and is probably looking probably the most overextended, was down in here today almost 4%. But that is one dynamic in a market which is prone to gaps. And it would really need to see some follow-through and probably a break below that 30,000 level to offset scope for near-term upside, whereas the overall uptrend remains very much intact. The other market that is certainly worthy of note, particularly for its action this week, is the Indian market. We've added a lot more Indian indices into the chart library over this week, and you'll find those to be quite interesting, I think. But probably the most important of all the bank indices right around the world is the Indian Bank Index. Not so much because it's an interesting buy right now because it is quite overextended, but because of its relative outperformance. When we contrast two markets, particularly the US and India, you can see in the US where banking shares are being hit really quite hard in here and confidence has left the market almost entirely. On the other hand, you have Indian banking shares which are making new all-time highs. And given the fact that we had some pretty weak action right across the boards yesterday, you had India hitting a new high on the banking index, the Bombay Bank Index, in here today. And that is remarkable relative strength against a background of really quite an ebb in confidence in the financial sector. It also points towards the strength of that bull market. And I think there is certainly a push now towards the emerging market sector. That is something we have talked about quite considerably over the last months and indeed years. And the rest of the world is slowly starting to catch on to the fact that Asia is the global center for GDP growth. It has the two largest population centers in the world. And it has remarkably young populations, together with the fact that historically the civilizations of Asia have been innovative and led the world in terms of GDP for many centuries up until relatively recently. And they are slowly starting to reclaim their place towards the upper side of developed nations. China is certainly leading the way there, and India is hot on its heels, although only really just starting its development track now. The Indian market is starting to be viewed by international investors quite a bit differently than when it had been the way it had been valued in years past. One of the reasons for that, obviously, is because of the growth there and the increasing push towards liberalization of the license raj, but also because the Indian rupee has broken its quite considerably long downtrend and is now looking like it's going to appreciate for the considerably longer term. We're talking decades here, and it could easily double in value. And when you combine that with the outperformance that you're seeing in the stock market right now, that is a compelling argument to have at least a position in the Indian market. And the fact that the market rallied so very well following the bit of a fracas that was in the market just only a couple of weeks ago when the regulators decided that they were going to try and close down the participatory note market. And the fact that the market has rallied, the Indian stock market has rallied so well since then, is an indication that people do have faith in it. It is, I will, would like to certainly say that this market is overextended in here right now, but the long-term potential of the Indian market is quite considerable, and it is certainly something that we at Fuller Money think that everybody should have a position or some sort of exposure there, because it's our favorite market for the very long term. But when we contrast India with the USA has a problem in the financial sector. David and I were talking about hypothetical situations and being a fly on the wall this morning, and it's not too difficult to imagine what to put ourselves in the shoes of the decision makers for the US economy. If you can imagine people like Bernanke and Paulson sitting down and talking about what they're going to do to help protect their market. It has been written about and books and volumes written on the housing problem, and that is not something that's going to go away, and you have that problem with resets coming up next year. That is unknowable, and that is probably something that the economy can muddle through. However, they will also want to, they are also very aware of how the stock market is performing. And with the rate cut that we had this week, a quarter of a point, bringing it down to below 5%, I think it's, sorry, 4.5%, excuse me. The Fed released an announcement saying that the risk to growth was about equal now to the risk to inflation. They were trying to give a signal that they weren't going to, they were going to be slow to lower rates further. That was because this rate cut that we got this week was largely priced into the market and was expected by markets, and they got what they wanted. The Fed was trying to dampen down the expectation that we were going to get a conveyor belt of rate cuts. That may yet be the case, but the central bank is very much in the business of managing expectations. However, what they will be very aware of is that the stock market, while it is certainly well off its August lows, the banking sector is in serious trouble, and the housing sector is in trouble. And if you have falling house prices and an economy that is very much dependent on the consumer, then you can't really afford to have a weak housing market and a weak stock market. So they will act to help support that market, the stock markets. Because the alternative is the recipe for a recession and potentially even a depression. And since that is something that they will fight tooth and nail to avoid, we can probably anticipate some further rate cuts going forward, although the Fed will be at pains to manage the expectations of what they're actually going to do. But the chances are we are going to get further rate cuts, particularly if the banking sector remains as weak as it is, and if there are threats to the consumer economy. The stock markets globally are in are relatively overextended as we speak in here today, following the really remarkably impressive rally that we've seen since the mid-August lows. But we believe that there is a reasonable chance that we're, I think a reasonably good chance, better than even, that the US is going to avoid recession, because we are going to get these rate cuts over the next 6 to 9 months, and they should help to support the stock market and support companies. The when I say support stock market, of course, that also means supporting corporations. And if you can muddle through on the housing side, provided the corporations are performing relatively well, the weaker dollar also helps in that regard. And of course, the other main one of the main concerns for policymakers will be the high oil price. And of course, that is uniquely important to the US because it's denominated in dollars and the dollar is getting weaker. Whereas if you look at oil in other currencies, it has obviously rallied quite considerably, but not nearly as much in euros or pounds, for example, than it has in US dollars. So that's another concern that policymakers will have. But they will be at pains to support the corporate sector. And they will manage the dollar lower. When we have talked considerably over the last month and longer about technology shares, and the best performers in that sector right now are those that depend on intellectual property. Microsoft is a software writer. Google is very much plugged in on the intellectual property side, whereas the manufacturing side of the technology sector is not performing to the same extent. And one of the reasons for that, perhaps not the main reason, but certainly one of the reasons for that, is the weaker dollar. Intellectual property companies benefit considerably from a weaker dollar because they're consolidating their earnings from abroad, whereas manufacturing companies also have manufacturing operations abroad, and their costs go up as the dollar goes down in those centers, whereas their consolidated earnings will also rise. So there may be a netting out, there may not be very much of a difference. Whereas for intellectual property or for companies that are manufacturing in the USA, they will get a considerable bonus from the weaker dollar. The Fed yesterday added $41 billion to the system, to the banking system, following the weakness in the banking shares. And you'll find a number of banking indices in the chart library, and I would suggest having a look at them because they will give you a very good idea of just how weak those bank shares are. But importantly, the central bank, the Fed, and right across the world, all central banks are adding liquidity to markets at a considerable pace. $41 billion yesterday by the Fed is one of the biggest additions of liquidity since 9/11. And it's certainly not the last, and it most definitely wasn't the first. These rate cuts that we've seen over the last couple of months are generally going to stoke the inflationary pressures over the medium to longer term. You certainly don't have inflation on the horizon right now, even with oil hitting new highs, because there is, while inflation fears are, or inflationary pressures are certainly growing, they're certainly not making headlines because they are much too afraid of recession. And even with the word depression being bandied around quite vigorously by a number of commentators, they are much more likely to err on the side of caution and support their economy rather than prevent inflation by raising interest rates. The amount of liquidity that is being pumped into the market, not just now, but indeed over the last 10 to 15 years, has been quite considerable. And with government bond yields bottoming in 2003, the very good chart to look at there is the 10-year Treasury. You can see the PNF chart. It goes back for in excess of 40 years. And yields today are lower than they have been at any time in the last 30 to 40 years. That's not a situation that will go on for very much longer. What we have seen is that they have bottomed. They are at the beginning of a new uptrend, or at the worst, a basing out period. What we can anticipate, because we know that there is this incredible amount of liquidity entering the system continually, and massive injections have followed every crisis that we've had in at least the last 10 years. You had the Russian debt default, the Asian financial crisis, the Mexican peso, what was it, the tequila crisis, the Y2K crisis, the 9/11 crisis. Last year you had the May correction, massive injection of liquidity, and again just now with the subprime and credit crisis. And while that has certainly helped to support markets, and I wouldn't argue with that policy, and I would probably do exactly the same thing if I was doing that job, and thank God I'm not. I think it's probably the most difficult job in the world. But we can certainly rationalize or see the rationale behind their actions. But we know that that is an inflationary pressure on the global economy with the amount of liquidity that's been pumped in. And we've seen that government bond yields have bottomed. Right now, we're in a period where interest rates are coming down and yields are falling, and that could go on for a year. But rates are not going to fall back below where their low was back in 2003, 2004. And next time they start to rise, they're almost certainly going to hit a peak above where they peaked just recently. And that's the definition of an uptrend, where you have higher lows and higher highs. It's a secular uptrend, so it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take years. It could take in excess of a decade to get back into a consistent uptrend or get to its all-time high. But we can expect periods where there will be inflationary pressures, and central banks will have to be seen to be dealing with those inflationary pressures. But when the economy runs into trouble, they will cut interest rates vigorously. I think David has mentioned in a number of audios this week that interest rates should go up in an escalator and down in an elevator. And we saw the 50 basis point cut only 6 weeks ago. We saw 25 basis points, which could easily have been 50 basis points, and they probably erred in not doing that. But we are likely to see cycles within this secular uptrend where we see inflationary pressures rising and then contracting afterwards. But they were unlikely to see rates go back below the lows of the previous cycle, and when they rise, they will probably rise higher than the present cycle. That means we can see yields rising considerably over the next 10 years to combat those growing inflationary fears. Historically, when you've had a commodity boom, it's always had a knock-on effect in providing inflation. Because regardless of your currency, sooner or later, if everything else that you depend on for your living costs more, then that is inflationary. And the commodity sector is booming quite considerably, with the energy sector in particular, because obviously that is hitting new highs in here right now, and that is the one that's hitting the headlines. It was also one of the first ones to start moving. With Asia growing at a rate which is enormous but also sustainable for the longer term, and with in excess of 2 billion people urbanizing over the next 20 to 30 years, it's the greatest urbanization in history. And there was a report I posted during the week, I think it was from Citigroup, and they said that there were three secular trends this century. One was the industrialization of the US in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and there was another large super cycle in commodities following the Second World War with the rebuilding of Europe and Japan. And now we're seeing the rebuilding of the traditional superpowers in Asia, which were China and India. And this is a move that could take 20 or 30 years, just as it did with the last two super cycles. Indeed, commodity super cycles generally tend to last longer. But with this incredible number of people entering the global economy, that puts enormous pressure on the supply of just about all resources. They have infrastructure to build, and they have aspirations to the standard of living that we take for granted in the Western world. And they're very likely to attain it. But it does mean that China and increasingly India will be competing far more strongly for physical resources, and with that competition, the prices are likely to rise. Potentially with the energy sector, the actual energy prices are likely to go up quite a lot because you have the major fields in the world declining growing demand, but supply is well, producers are finding it much harder to grow supply to keep in line with the growing demand, and there is a shortfall there that there doesn't appear to be any way of making up. So we can anticipate the energy sector continuing to rise. Now, of course, it's also not only being the most important commodity in the world, it's also the most political. So it's characteristically volatile and prone to some rather large corrections. But that will not negate the upward potential for the energy complex. On the other hand, it will be far more difficult to play the energy complex through shares because there is an increasing trend right around the world towards nationalization, and the best fields are increasingly being taken over by the governments of the countries where they sit. Traditionally, those big oil companies, and you had that worrying results from Exxon just this week, where their production actually fell over the last quarter. And that is something that we can probably anticipate to continue going forward because they're not making the new discoveries necessary to replenish what they're taking out of the fields that they do own. And deals that they've made with governments right across Africa and South America are probably not worth the paper they're written on because the next government could just as easily cancel the contract as the one previously had written it. So it will be much more difficult to play the energy complex. On the other hand, the benefit of the industrial metals complex, which also is in a remarkable bull market, is that many of the resources in or many of those big companies, their resources are in politically stable parts of the world. For example, Canada and Australia, and to an extent, Brazil. And those companies are well managed and they actually own their own resources, and there's very little chance of their resources being expropriated by whichever government is elected in a democracy. So they are much more likely to represent the industrial metal complex than those large oil companies are to represent the oil complex. And industrial metals are currently, I think it would be fair to say that they're consolidating, but their bull market is still very much intact. With the inflationary pressures that are being put on the global economy by the constant injections of liquidity and the increasing commodity prices, we're seeing precious metals hitting new highs. And given the fact that gold consolidated for well in excess of a year and has just broken up recently and is in actually quite a consistent uptrend with three-step sequence consolidations, one above another, of a relatively equal size. Although it must be said that the most recent one was of a shorter duration than the last two. I think if we were going to look for one market where we were going to see an acceleration developing, it's probably going to be in the precious metal sector. They've been building up, they've got a lot of underlying trading, the dollar is weak, and there are nascent inflationary pressures out there. And together with the fact, of course, that oil is hitting new highs, these are all positives for the precious metals sector. And I think it is only a matter of time before we see quite a considerable acceleration there. And not just, of course, in gold. Silver has lagged recently, but it has a bigger percentage move. Well, it had until recently, at least, from its August lows. And it is capable of playing catch-up in quite spectacular fashion. And, of course, platinum up nearly $12 in here today, 1462. And, sorry, 1462, excuse me. But in a very consistent uptrend. So that is also something to be very much aware of. Increasingly, we're also starting to see the agricultural commodities doing much better, and agricultural stocks have been in really quite impressive uptrends for much of the last 2 years, although they are looking a bit expensive in here right now. But importantly, when the countries, particularly in Asia, are developing, and you're seeing a huge number of people moving off of subsistence, survival, levels of consumption, the first thing that they're going to start buying is better food. And obviously, after that, they'll start moving on to better clothing, better housing, and better transportation. But the first thing that they will do is buy better food. They will eat well. And this is the first global secular bull market in grains and in other consumable commodities. Because in the past, and you can see this if you look at the longer term charts, the grains in particular are very much prone to spikes. They've got a short growing season, unlike, for example, coffee, where it takes upwards of 3 years for a plant to actually produce beans. But grains can be grown 1 year, and another grain can be grown the next. What we've seen recently is that grains had accelerated to highs and they'd fallen back, but they haven't fallen back anywhere near towards the lows or towards their bases. They've actually held up really quite well, because even though we have had some speculation, particularly in corn, because of the biofuels and ethanol, but even though we've had reasonably good harvests, in fact, we've had very good harvests over the last 10 years, global stockpiles are at historically low levels. And that's not even factoring in the possibility of droughts or storms destroying the global crop. We've had a little bit of that this year with a shortage of wheat. And wheat encountered some resistance above $9 on the US quoted contract. And you had some even larger accelerations on the European quoted contracts, and that is pulling back gradually in here. It's actually falling considerably slower than it went up because there is underlying demand in the market. And that is something that we can continue to expect from the grain markets, because demand for these basic resources, these foods, is growing at an impressive pace and is not something that has been factored into the longer term projections of most investors. That is something that is probably going to change, and we can expect the agricultural equities and the commodities themselves to continue to hit new highs going forward, although they will remain very, very volatile, because they are also a political commodity, because everyone needs to eat, but also because they're very weather dependent and weather can change. I think that's very much of a truism. But looking at the development that we're seeing in Asia today, with the per capita consumption of various different resources growing at an absolutely inexorable rate, we can anticipate that the commodity demand will continue to rise, and it will be a challenge to meet that demand. But that is only one of our investment themes, the resources sector. The other is emerging Asia. It's the biggest urbanization in history. And with that number of people entering the market and their productive capabilities and the considerably well-educated populations, particularly in India and China, they're going to have a massive impact on stock market valuations in those countries, not just now, although because we've just had some really quite impressive performances, but over the much longer term. And with GDP growing, with populations rising, with young people entering the workforce who are well educated and ambitious and willing to work, with investment from around the world flowing into the region because it's a high growth area, and with currencies in that area rising considerably from the very depressed levels that most of those currencies have been at since the Asian financial crisis, that is a perfect recipe for strong growth in their stock markets, strong growth in currency, strong GDP growth. And while it's probably at the moment a nicer place to live in the developed West, it's almost definitely a better place to invest would be in Asia, where you have all of this growth and the dynamism of those economies. And India, of course, being our favorite of those, but David has often referred to China and India as being the king and queen of the emerging markets. And when we think about investing, we can obviously invest directly in those economies and benefit from the currency appreciation just by owning those stocks. But of course, the countries that benefit from the development of places like China and India will also do very well. And commodity currencies are also in an uptrend and are likely to continue to get stronger. The Canadian dollar is at 93 cents, 90, almost 93 and a half cents in here today, went through parity only a couple of weeks ago and is continuing in its uptrend. The Australian dollar looks like it's going to hit parity to the US dollar. Really, it could be any week now. And it's unlikely that that's going to be an area of anything other than temporary resistance for it. But that is also a secular trend. And while the growth we're going to see, and we are seeing right across Asia, is impressive, we're also going to see very strong growth in those commodity currencies and commodity economies. What I haven't talked about yet are the government bond sector. I touched on the rising yields, and of course, I would actually extol anybody to go in and look at not the just the daily prices of the government bond sector. One of the important charts, I think, is the Australian government bond chart. And you can look at that over the last 10 or 15 years. It looks like an incredibly large topping formation. So we can expect yields to rise right across the commodity currencies or the commodity economies, and they'll probably rise considerably higher than what we're seeing right now. But government bond prices are topping out. It's a very gradual process, and with yields weak right now, and we could conceivably see yields weak for at least as long as it takes for the markets to start thinking that interest rates are going to start rising again in the Western world. But that is something that we really need to keep an eye on, because with these big top formations, they are explosions waiting to happen, and it is only a matter of time before we see prices starting to fall really quite considerably. That's probably not going to happen this side of 2008. It may not even happen in 2008, but it is something that we know is almost inevitable. When you see these large top formations, it is almost inconceivable that they're going to break upwards and hit new highs, because yields would have to go to zero, and that is extremely unlikely. So that is something to keep in mind, and it is also why we have often said that we would be unwilling to buy bonds and we're looking for shorting opportunities. Personally, I've said that I know on a number of occasions, and usually when the shorting opportunity comes, there are better opportunities out there in terms of chart action, and I haven't done it. But that doesn't negate the fact that this is a congenitally weak sector, which has been damaged by the incredible amount of supply that is out there. There is no shortage of bonds, but the currencies that they're being issued in are worth considerably less than investors actually predict. And with that thought, I will leave you for the weekend, but thank you very much for your time.